Good afternoon. We only have one case on our docket for oral argument this afternoon. But before we have the clerk announce that case, I'll introduce to you the panel. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my left is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So if the clerk will call the case. Mr. Sears, you may proceed.
May it please the court. There is a single legal determination that lies at the center of this entire case, and that is Judge Walker's erroneous decision that, as the result of a resolution signed by the shareholders of the firm in 2014, the firm was empowered to seize David Skeels' shares in 2015 without paying anything for them. That legal determination underlies the grant of declaratory judgment, the award of declaratory judgment fees, the exclusion of some of David Skeels' valuation evidence, and the sanctions award against Skeels. And that single determination is wrong. The TBOC does not permit extinguishment, and the 2014 resolution doesn't even purport to provide the authority that the firm claims it to have. And that requires reversal of all of the relevant court rulings in this case. Starting with the code, the TBOC has no provision relating to extinguishment. There's only one way to take a shareholder's shares in a professional corporation away involuntarily under the code, and that would be a redemption under 303.004. A redemption under 303 and a redemption under that provision requires that the terms and conditions, that the terms and the price for the redemption be specified in advance in one of several different kinds of documents. Now, the firm doesn't say that the resolution provides those terms or the price of the redemption anywhere in its contents. What they say instead is that while they rely on 303.004 as one of the grounds for the authority to extinguish shares, they don't actually have to comply with its terms. They don't have to have an advance agreement on price. But a redemption, by its very definition, is an agreement that has an advance agreement on the price under which the redemption will occur. That's what defines a redemption. It is essentially an option contract. And by using that term, the legislature made sure to understand that that is not an optional term, that is required. And the rest of 303.004 confirms that plain, ordinary meaning of the term redemption applies. There are options provided in 303.004. Provision A allows a firm to decide whether to allow for redemptions or to provide anything in any of its documents to allow for redemptions. It's not required to redeem shares. Subsection B has options too. It has options about where the price and the terms for redemption might be located. They can be included in a governing document. They can be included in a shareholder agreement. They can be included in a specialized agreement between the board of directors and the shareholder directly. But they've got to be recorded somewhere. That is not optional, and that's confirmed, as we've said in our brief, by the legislative history and the drafting history of 303.004 and its predecessors. That brings us to the firm's central argument, and that is that they think that the 2014 resolution is a shareholder agreement, and as such, they think that it can trump any of the provisions of the code, including 303.004, or anything else that might stand in the way of them doing essentially whatever they like with the firm. There's a variety of reasons why that will not work. The first is that they obtained a declaratory judgment that this document is a governing document. And so it falls into the bucket of governing document under 303.004. It isn't a shareholder agreement. At least that's what Judge Walker declared it not to be. The underlying legal theory is also just wrong.
Counsel, can you help me with the timeline here? When was the 2014 resolution entered into by all of the shareholders of the firm? What date?
The date is February the 11th of 2014.
And that was February 11th, 2014, okay? And as of, according to memorandum from Carol Cameron to the shareholders on January 23rd of 2014, no stocks had actually been distributed to the newer partners at that point in time. Is that correct?
That's correct. They didn't have share certificates.
Okay.
They were considered to be shareholders in the firm.
Well, was there any documentation that demonstrated them to be
shareholders
at that point in time?
There's nothing in the record. There's no shareholder agreement or any formalized agreement determining them to be shareholders in the firm, other than the firm, you know, the firm did treat them as shareholders. They do sign the resolution as shareholders.
Okay, the subject matter of the memorandum from Ms. Cameron is an audit update. When was the firm given notice of the audit?
I'm not familiar with the actual
Is that in the record anywhere?
That is in the record, and I can give you an update for that.
Okay, but the audit had not actually concluded by the time of the 2014 resolution?
It was in advance of the 2014 resolution was in advance of the audit, which I think was in April of 2014. I'm not
okay.
sure about that.
And to your knowledge, the record reflects that the firm was filing its tax liability documents with the IRS as a professional corporation at that point in time.
Are you asking up
to that point in time?
Just to be clear, they had filed with the Texas Secretary of State as a professional corporation.
Understood, but they were also, in terms of tax liability with regard to the professional corporation, they were making representations that they were filing as a professional corporation up until that point in time. Is it
correct?
That's right,
and I'm not sure that there's anything in the record.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that some of the things that were needed to be done as far as Ms. Cameron is concerned needed to be done because it might draw into question whether or not representations made to the IRS about the status of their filing, in other words, that there were actual shareholders with shares that had actually been distributed, okay, as opposed to shareholders who didn't have any documentation that they were actually shareholders. Is there anything in the record that indicates that that might have been a question?
I don't think there was a specific question. I think the larger concern was just formalizing the internal workings of the firm generally. That is to say, they didn't have corporate minutes and they didn't have bylaws. And the only things that they really did, again, were their filings with the Secretary of State where they updated their firm name. So back to the argument that the 2014 resolution is a shareholder agreement. Beyond the fact that they obtained declaratory judgment that it wasn't a shareholder agreement, it was a governing document. The theory underlying this idea that they could override 303.004 is wrong. I kind of emphasized the legal arguments in our brief, but I don't think the court ultimately needs to reach those for our purposes because you can't read the resolution. Even if it had the potential to be a shareholder agreement that could override the code, you can't read the resolution to do so. And I think that's true for several different reasons. For one thing, it's hard to make the 2014 resolution a shareholder agreement at all. It is not an enforceable contract, and shareholder agreements under the TBOC have to be enforceable. There's no consideration recorded in the agreement for the alleged bargain, and there's no evidence that anything else was given.
Did you make that argument at the trial court?
We did not specifically make that argument in the trial court.
You argue many times that they didn't make an argument at the trial court, so they can't make it now. What makes your argument that you didn't make at the trial court different?
Well, this is the argument that we made at the trial court is that this was not authorized. So we're not going to raise new issues. We are entitled to make new arguments to support the arguments that the central issue in this case, and the central issue is whether this is authorized. So as far as consideration goes, that is part of it. And this argument about this being a shareholder agreement, it is a revision of the argument that they made in the trial court as well. So I think we're entitled at least to respond to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Why should we not look at that agreement, though, as basically the the non-founding shareholders giving up their shareholder status, because it looks like the agreement basically turns it into a three-member partnership, and the shareholders give up all their rights because they literally have no rights that are enforceable under any type. If it's a shareholder agreement, they have no rights that are enforceable under the shareholder agreement.
Well, for one thing, it's not.
And you haven't argued that it's not enforceable because it doesn't have consideration, but it's still.
Yes,
you're in fact arguing it's a governing agreement, so it's in fact a binding agreement. You just are characterizing it differently than how they're characterizing it. But if we find it to be a shareholder agreement, and there's no question that it's binding, then why have they not just effectively created a different entity with that?
There's absolutely nothing specific in the 2014 resolution that changes the nature of the entity, that changes the nature of anyone's status. Everyone signs the agreement as a shareholder.
Well, then name me one thing, okay? Name me one thing that the three founding shareholders cannot do without some type of approval of the other shareholders. And how that's different from what was before.
Well, I think that hits on something pretty critical about the 2014 resolution, and that it distributes powers to individual shareholders, to the founding shareholders of the firm. It gives them power. It doesn't give the firm any new power. So if the firm wasn't permitted before the 2014 resolution to redeem shares or to extinguish shares or do anything like that, the firm didn't acquire any new power to do anything. And I think that's confirmed by the fact that this resolution isn't meant to change anything fundamental about the partner, about the corporation. It isn't meant to turn it into a partnership. It isn't meant to surrender anyone's shareholder status.
How do we know what the fundamental aspects of the firm are when the documents with regard to minutes and shares, etc., actually don't comport with what a professional corporation is supposed to be?
Well, with respect, I think they do, in the most basic sense, comport with what a professional corporation is meant to be, which is they've filed as a professional corporation, they've issued shares to their shareholders, and they've memorialized them in certificates, but at least they treated the shareholders as having shares.
Were there shares issued to the founders at the time they, in fact, created the corporation, does the record indicate that?
There's no record.
Does the record indicate that any share certificate existed before share certificates were created pursuant to this memo?
There is no record of any share certificate, but there's not necessarily.
As far as this record is concerned, this is a professional corporation with shareholders who do not possess actual shares.
Well, I think number one, I think that it is a professional corporation. They do have shares. But number two, I think this is critical both for our declaratory judgment cause of action, the authorization of the firm, and also for our breach of contract action. They treated their shareholders as shareholders. They compensated them as shareholders. They gave them profits in the firm. They treated their shares as having value, whether they were certificated or not. And so I think the formality of it is less of an issue than the actual treatment.
What evidence in the record is they treated those shares as having value?
They treated those shares, because every time.
Because you wanted to know how they valued the shares, and you didn't get that information, and then the only thing you knew is that they valued Mr. Skills at zero.
No, I think that's not quite correct.
Okay.
They valued his shares at $75,000 before they decided to try and seize
them. That's a settlement argument, okay? And unless I see an actual agreement that says we'll pay you $75,000 for your shares, which I'm guessing isn't in the record, okay?
Well, you're not.
That's an argument you're making. I understand that, but there's nothing in the record that actually indicates any value for these shares.
Well, if you're asking whether or not they treated them as having value, they treated them as having value with regard to Mr. Skiles. Whether or not it was formalized in an agreement, I don't think that undermines the practice. Also, when it came to other departing shareholders, they treated those shares as having value. They were surrendered for not necessarily property or cash, but they were surrendered in exchange for exiting agreements and
settlements. Is there something in the record that supports that?
Yes.
What?
During the preliminary injunction, I don't have the citations with me, and I'll update the court with you. But yes, during the preliminary injunction hearing, they went into several departing shareholders and the agreements that they reached as they were leaving. The terms of the agreements are not in there, but it was established at the hearing that...
That they got paid for their shares.
They didn't receive cash, but no one disputes, and the other side doesn't dispute, that they received things of value. They received consideration.
Had they received things of value, but for their shares?
For their shares.
For their shares.
That was a condition of the agreements that they signed when they left, was that they surrender their shares, and in exchange, they received promises. Sometimes they got to take work with them. There were a variety of different considerations offered.
Okay.
And so I want to return back to the idea of practice. The 2014 resolution is meant to memorialize a practice of the firm. It isn't actually meant to convey any new powers to the firm or even to the founding shareholders. It's really to memorialize what they could already do and to make sure going forward that they can continue to handle the day-to-day management of affairs of the firm, and that they would continue to be able to outvote the junior shareholders, even if the shareholders could amass, you know, now they had share certificates, and so now they would be able to use their share certificates to outvote the senior partners, the senior shareholders.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there. Your time has expired.
Okay.
So you'll have your rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Okay.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Cook. John Souter is also a party to this case. He regrets not being here today. He's in trial in federal court out of state. Otherwise, he would be here. I'm going to address the issues regarding the resolution, the firm's action with respect to the shares, to the extent there's time left over. Mr. Myers, if he doesn't have any cleanup for me, he'll be addressing some of the other issues, including the monetary awards, to the extent the court has questions about those. I think that this issue... in terms of the firm's activity with respect to the shares, comes down to two issues. One is how broadly can shareholders agree among themselves to handle relationships with one another, including the disposition of shares, including but not limited to that. How can you agree to that? The second issue is...
Well, counsel, can you... do an agreement that eviscerates the very nature of the corporation? Because I don't see any limitation to the authority that is taken by the three founding shareholders at that point in time vis-a-vis the other shareholders.
Your Honor, I would say under that...
I mean, there's literally no decision, okay?
In other words, the idea would be, can we treat it, have a partnership, a professional corporation be treated as though it's a partnership, for example?
Well, where it might actually be a partnership and therefore subject to different laws, if it is in fact a partnership, then I'm more inclined to buy your at-will argument in that regard, okay? The problem is if you are, and I'm not sure you want us to find you're a partnership because that'll have implications elsewhere, okay?
Your Honor, I think the way I would address that is this, if I track with you. First of all, I agree with opposing counsel in that there were shareholders in the firm from the very beginning. That you have a share certificate that memorializes an ownership interest or rights in the corporation is different than having actual rights. Black letter law, there's law that says that. To this point, that has not been an issue in the case, but that is the law. So we agree that Mr. Skeels was a shareholder. The founding shareholders were issued. That share certificates had not been issued yet does not change that. Tax returns were filed, taxes paid, accounting records with the franchise taxes in the state were all done that way. As opposing counsel said, the party acted as that. What I'm suggesting in terms of back to your question about the restrictions, on the breadth of it, the Professional Corporations Act on shareholder agreements says they are broad, very broad. In fact, the reason I brought the partnership is that you can act as though you are a partner. That's what the code says in the catch-all provision, section 21.101A12. You can go that far. The requirements are, the only requirements are that it not be against public policy and that all shareholders sign in writing. Otherwise, including in Ritchie versus Rip, the Supreme Court said the legislature intended that shareholders in a professional corporation or even non-professional corporation can have broad powers to do act however they agree, even if though it's a partnership. So that's why we say that this shareholder agreement is extremely broad. Now, they want to drag the court back into Section 303 of the Professional Corporations Act, but you never need to go there. And in fact,
well, partnerships normally don't have shares, do they, counsel?
They do not.
And ordinarily, partnerships don't deal with how to redeem shares, do they?
They deal with
so how are we supposed to say that this agreement is broad enough to create effectively a professional corporation that can, under the law, act as a partnership, okay, but in acting as a partnership, deal with something that partnerships don't do?
So, Your Honor, I think there's a distinction here. The entity, the firm, acted as though it was a professional corporation. Did it not have share certificates for a while? No, but it eventually issued them. But it acted that in every way. We had minutes. There were documents, not a ton of them, but they existed. The point is that when it comes to the catch-all provision in 102.12a or A12, it says the parties can reach an agreement to govern the relationships among themselves however they want, including as though it were a partnership, the full extent of a partnership. That's the relationships among one another, unless it's against public policy. So that's why it's not that we're a partnership. We are a professional corporation. We have been since January 1, 1993, when we filed our articles of incorporation. But that,
so what
that's
authority? What authority do you have, the provision you're relying on, the shareholder agreement argument, okay? Mm-hmm. But Judge Walker didn't actually make that finding. He argued it, but he didn't make that finding, okay? But if we were to credit that, what authority do you have that quite literally, in using the term you can act like a partnership, you can literally eviscerate every aspect, protection, right, obligation under the statutes and the documents creating the professional corporation itself?
Your Honor, first of all, Judge Walker, in the hearing where he actually heard the substantive arguments for 2 hours, said these words. Ultimately, he found the way he did under this provision because, as his words, I quote him, a deal's a deal. That's what he said. Now, the order may talk about a governing document, which this is, but that was the basis of his ruling and the record. And those were his exact words. But in terms of the authority I have is the actual statute itself, subsection 12, which says that the relationship among the shareholders, the directors and corporations, as if the corporation were a partnership.
Okay, so I'm guessing you don't have any.
That would otherwise be appropriate.
So I'm guessing you don't have any authority that directly addressed the interrelationship between 303.004 redemption and this aspect of Chapter 21.
Your Honor, the only authority I have, which I believe is the best authority in the case, is that this says that we can agree however you want to. And if you look at Section 21.104, it says, even if it's inconsistent with other parts of this code. So the fact that Section 303 says something about that you pointed to, doesn't matter because we can agree inconsistently with Section 303. That's the death knell of their argument. They want to drag the court there, but they can't. Parties can agree to this, and they did. The next question then becomes, I would submit, is that what in fact
did they agree? Go for the scope. Okay, what's the scope of the agreement? It sounds like basically we get to do whatever we want to do. We'll take the benefits of being a professional corporation, but when it suits us, we'll take the benefits of being a partnership.
It is. I just disagree, Your Honor. We'll have to,
okay,
have
that's
to
fine.
Agree to disagree. What I would say is that the we were able to do what we needed to do to run the firm, to manage the firm, to decide who would enter and exit the firm, and we could do that as long as it was not against public policy. In construing this agreement, which you have to do just like any contract construction, is you need to look at not only the plain and ordinary meaning, the breadth of the words, but also the circumstances in which it was entered into. In this particular case, you have to remember, the founding shareholders put all the money into the firm, to start the firm, to do finish out. When the firm's light on cash, they supply the capital. No junior shareholder ever put any money into the firm. They didn't pay for a share. They didn't fund anything.
What was the point of the shareholding privilege then?
The point of the share in our particular firm,
yeah,
unless you're a founding shareholder, here's what it gets you. It gets you the ability, the status to say that you have that to the community, and it allows you to participate in a compensation system where, by and large, the junior shareholders made more money than they were making as an associate. But when it came to fundamental adders, remember, the whole point of this is
that the founding partners, the founding shareholders, could change the terms of that compensation at will, to the point of sending somebody packing and valuing their shares at zero. So there's literally nothing that can't be changed about the nature of your practice as a professional corporation without, as far as the three are concerned.
As you said earlier, Your Honor, that's what they agreed to. It's that broad. That's what they agreed to. But the point of it is that we are in a situation where we're going to have shareholders with equal amounts of shares, where the founders who started the firm, paid for the firm, grew the firm, decide who comes in, could be outnumbered. And so this resolution gives those three basically an agreement to make sure that we can never have this firm taken away from us. We can decide who enters and who exits. And that's when you read this, you have to construe it in those particular circumstances.
Why should we not read this agreement as essentially dissolving the professional corporation and creating, in fact, a partnership?
Well, because for one thing, you'd have to find intent in the record, and you have both sides' lawyers apparently telling you that that wasn't the case. You would look at the mountain of evidence of how the corporation has treated itself and acted over the years in terms of how it paid taxes, the franchise filings, tax returns, meetings, resolutions, things like that. It would just be like this in terms of the evidence against it.
Okay, your time has. If you want to give Mr. Myers his time, your time has expired.
Okay, I'll dip into it a little longer then. He can kick me on the way home if that turns out to be the case. Thank you, Your Honor, for the
five.
So, when you get to the scope of the resolution, and you look at those circumstances which was entered into, and you apply the plain and ordinary meaning, and this is truly the death knell for their claim. When you talk about the scope of affirmative action taken on behalf of the firm, Mr. Skiles admitted under oath that redemption falls within that language. In other words, when you look at the black and white, and it says,
in other words, counsel, he admitted that that redemption would be an affirmative act, and that would fall within the terms of the agreement, but he didn't admit that the agreement actually said redemption was part of the affirmative conduct under the circumstances.
He said that the words, the firm may take affirmative action on behalf of the firm, included redemption of shares. Now, he may say, he has said in his brief, and perhaps may say when he returns for his rebuttal, that, oh, well, I meant redemption as they define redemption. Now, what particular definition they give it under Section 303. But that's irrelevant, because consider this. Think of this. The fact that he agrees that redemption falls within that language is he's telling you, he's admitting that there's actions that the firm can take involving the reacquisition of shares, of extinguishing rights, that's in that language.
So is it your position now that these shares were redeemed or extinguished?
I don't know that it matters for practical purposes, Your Honor, and here's why.
Well, but you argued in your brief extinguished.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to be clear. What is your position now?
The position is that the shares were extinguished. That is, we declared and decided that he was no longer a shareholder at the end of the 2015, thereabouts, that opposing counsel, excuse me, our counsel, Mr. Myers, attempted to dialogue with Darrell Keith, who was his lawyer at the time, about would he please recognize that, voluntarily recognize that he had no rights, and this is temporary hearing exhibit number 11. When they refused and refused to do that, Mr. Myers said, then as an abundance of caution, we'll go through a procedure of redemption just to put some structure to this. And so the time period passed, gave notice, and they were redeemed for $0. So the reason I say that, Your Honor, is that that was done out of an abundance of caution. But whether it's extinguishing or redeeming for $0, the fact of the matter is that the firm decided and took action that he no longer had rights as a shareholder, as the resolution permits the firm to do. The other thing I would say is, in terms of, there's something that, again, that has been raised in the briefs that's important that was not raised below. And I'm touching on this in the event that they bring this up in rebuttal. And that is that in the course of the briefs, they tried to raise that the firm's actions with respect to the shares would have been a breach of fiduciary duty. Okay? And that is nowhere in this case. And I want the record to be clear about that. When Mr. Keith was his lawyer, before he got his second set of lawyers, Mr. Skiles asserted in his first amended petition a breach of fiduciary duty based on the shareholders or the corporation's redemption of shares, terminating his rights, that sort of thing.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Can the agreement that's contemplated by Chapter 21 that allows you to become a partnership or to act as a partnership, even though you're a professional corporation, can the agreement eliminate fiduciary duties that are created through the statutory requirements to meet the definition of a professional corporation?
Your Honor, that issue is not before the court. No
one's briefed. Sure it is, because you're asking us to interpret the language in Chapter 21 to effectively say that literally anything that is created anywhere else in the business organizations code, including fiduciary duties owed in professional corporations, you're asking us to interpret that that means that's what that means, and that that's the deal's the deal, and they agreed to effectively lose any and all rights that they had at the whim of the three founding shareholders.
Your Honor, again, I'll preface by saying I haven't had the chance or opportunity to brief or look at it, but I will fly off the cuff tell you that I believe that there is law that specifically describes how you go about and the circumstances under which you could do a waive or get rid of a fiduciary duty. We're not purporting that that happened here. We've never taken a position one way or the other.
You're taking a position that this was an agreement, that was a shareholder agreement that was broad enough to literally eviscerate any obligation, duty, anything that's required as far as professional corporations are concerned under the business organizations code.
Your Honor, we are not taking the position that it would counter or stop anything that would be contrary to public policy. So, for example,
what about the public policy with regard to the redemption of shares? You're saying that's not a matter of public policy, even though it's stated categorically in the organization's code? In other words, I'm trying to figure out where the agreement has any limitation, and if it doesn't have any limitation, whether that may in fact be against public policy to begin with.
On that specific point, in terms of 303, redemption of shares, the statute could not be more clear that the parties can agree otherwise, even inconsistent with other parts of the code, such as Section 303. That is black letter Section 21.104. That's where it is. That permits you. My point with breach of fiduciary duty was is that he then amended his petition, omitted that claim, and so effectively he didn't even propose jury instructions. It wasn't in his pleading. The idea that they're now trying to say breach of fiduciary duty is totally out of this case.
Okay, your time has expired. If you would give appellant's counsel 3 extra minutes, that's about how much he was talking during the questioning.
And I appreciate it, Your Honor. Justice Birdwell, I think you're wrestling with something that's an important issue in this case, and that is the breadth that we should give to this resolution and the consequences that flow if we do.
Well, and you're wrestling with the fact that your client signed it.
Well, I mean, I don't think that that's a problem for us because I don't.
Okay,
think
you need to explain why then.
Yes, because I think that the agreement is far, the resolution is far more narrow than the other side makes it out to be. I think that, again, it's our position that that resolution doesn't give any new powers to the firm, and it doesn't add the power to extinguish errors or to do anything inconsistent with the code that the firm could otherwise not do, because it doesn't provide that power. What it says is that it gives them the founding shareholders to exercise the power that the firm has. It doesn't change anything else about what it does. And I think it's perilous and very, very, very troublesome to try and give it the overwhelmingly broad reading that they want to give that language. These kinds of resolutions happen all of the time. And if you're going to read it so broadly and so unboundedly as to say that effectively they're handing the founding shareholders on behalf of the firm to do literally anything, then that basically gets rid of the TBOC entirely, because you'll find these kinds of resolutions in all kinds of professional corporations. Another thing that's important here, and I think that opposing counsel touched on this, is that even at the end of the day, even if the firm had the power to take away his shares, does have fiduciary duties to not exercise those powers arbitrarily.
Now, but you did not assert a breach of fiduciary cause of action.
We did assert a breach of fiduciary.
We did, but it was not the live pleading.
This is not a breach of fiduciary duty cause of action either. It is a limitation on the authority of a redeeming shareholder. It is a fiduciary duty only limits his power to do that. We're not asking for recovery for breach of fiduciary duty. This is not a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And so it is, again, in assistance of the argument that we've made here that this action was unauthorized. It was unauthorized because it was a breach of fiduciary duty. And I wanted to touch on one other question that you mentioned. Can the resolution waive a breach of fiduciary duty claim or fiduciary duty that they owe as shareholders in redemption? It cannot do that. The TBOC is clear that at the very end of its authority, a shareholder agreement can override the terms of the TBOC. It cannot override anything else. There would have to be something specific in this resolution. It would have to be an enforceable contract even more so, but there would have to be something specific about tort duties, especially when you're talking about breach of fiduciary duties. Sometimes these are required, and I can't give you the law off the top of my head, but there are conspicuousness. There are clarity rules about waiving tort duties, especially of the intentional variety. And this resolution doesn't mention anything about tort duties.
But if you didn't bring a breach of fiduciary duty claim, then that doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah, well, no, we think it does matter. It's still because this is not a breach of fiduciary duty claim at all. It's just another reason why the redemption or the extinguishment was unauthorized. And I want to end with one more point, and that is that the TBOC does allow a lot of things to be done by shareholder agreement. It does not allow involuntary seizure of shares for two reasons. One, 303.004 says that agreements of whatever kind have got to follow their rules under 303.004. They've got to have the terms of the redemption specified in advance. The price and the terms have got to be in the agreement. And now, and when we get down to it, when it comes down to Mr. Skeels' admission, he may have admitted that the word action on behalf of the firm, that phrase may encompass redemption as a general matter. It cannot import the price or terms for redemption into an agreement that doesn't have it.
Let me ask you something. Were the shares ever actually distributed?
Yes, they were short.
Okay.
Were
there any terms with regard to the certificates with regard to redemption or anything else?
There were no terms.
These weren't just blank pieces of paper saying this is a share.
It's a share certificate. It looks like a share certificate. It does not contain anything specific about redemption. In a normal corporation, that would be fatal to their argument, because a share certificate must have the right of redemption on it in order for a regular corporation to redeem shares.
When were the shares issued? Were they issued before the resolution was signed off by everybody or after? And is that in the record?
It is in the record, and I'm going to have to look it up, because I do not recall exactly the date.
Okay, because if it was after everybody signed off, then the three founding shareholders issued those shares at their discretion. That was an affirmative act by the three founding shareholders. Would that make our analysis any different?
I don't think it changes anything, really. And one more point. Let's say that the resolution were so broad as to trump everything in the TBOC and to convert this essentially into a partnership. Even a partnership cannot redeem shares arbitrarily. It cannot extinguish shares. 152.602 of the TBOC says that the shareholder is going, if he's withdrawn or he's taken out of the partnership, he's still going to get the fair value of his shares.
Even with a shareholder agreement such as we have in this case?
If it comes down to the TBOC provisions, I think that it's still going to require the fair value be given. And one other consideration that goes into the interpretation of the agreement, when we're talking about inconsistency, well, there's nothing inconsistent between the resolution and any term of the TBOC. It doesn't say anything specific about, you know, things like, well, we're going to change the voting requirements of the TBOC. And I think that we should strain to avoid giving overbroad readings to resolutions that would give kind of all-encompassing powers to very, very generic kinds of resolutions, rather than allowing that to happen. And with that, we respectfully request the court to reverse the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for the briefs. They were well done, and the argument here today. It's been very helpful to us. Your case is submitted, and we are adjourned for the day.